You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, June 22nd, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this evening, Coven Synapathy. Coven, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Welcome.
What up?
First name.
So, Coven, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. What do you do?
Yeah, I'm a communicator, skeptic, mom of two, and several other things. But I mainly cover in my Forbes column and my other communication, health, medicine, parenting, biotechnology, agriculture, and the intersection of all these things.
That sounds like familiar territory.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty familiar.
Very nice.
We're buddies already.
What's your background?
I'm not a scientist. My undergrad was in English literature, but I grew up in a science family, a family full of doctors and scientists. So I've always kind of had that interest, but I really, you know, didn't care a whole lot about, to be honest, skepticism and critical thinking, although I always was a critical thinker, but I didn't care about the communication of these issues until after I became a parent and realized that a lot of the fear-based marketing and rhetoric is targeted at new parents and especially moms.
Yeah, mommy shaming over pseudoscience is huge. It's like almost a cottage industry.
Right. I mean, and I almost went down the wrong rabbit hole, I think, after I had my first kid, but fortunately I went the right way.
What do you mean? Like
I happened to get a copy of the baby book by Dr. Sears after my daughter was born. And I'm sitting here like, am I ruining her attachment to me for life? Like, what are the repercussions here? But then I found some more credible resources online. And I think that I could have gone either way with me. I mean, I always was a critical thinker, but some of these things sound plausible and I could have dug myself out eventually. But I was in kind of a hard place, like a lot of parents are when you have a new little one. So that kind of makes you extra vulnerable to woo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's a vulnerable population, parents. People are so full of misinformation. It's just, it's terrible. You know, they're just wading through so much health misinformation out there. I have to spend a lot of my time just undoing the damage, you know, that the internets and the popular media has done.
Yeah, just from a marketing perspective, because marketers know that a lot of times when a new parent buys a new diaper or formula, often they buy that product for years. They stick with it pretty much almost regardless of anything else. So they want to get you and they want to suck you in really quick and really fast, you know, and completely unrelated to any woo, just for regular stuff. So it's similar, I think, maybe in some ways with this other crazy stuff.
Right. So it's what you're saying, Bob, is it's important to catch this kind, any sort of nonsense that creeps along very early on in the process. Otherwise you may never be able to pull yourself out of it.
Right. I mean, and it's hard though to do it. I'm not sure if you've ever lurked in kind of the typical parenting forums online, but yeah, people are spreading it by word of mouth and it goes quite a ways.
Coven, what would you say are some of the worst things that you've seen out there other than anti-vax?
Well, I think related to anti-vax, some of the more recent news is covered refusal of the vitamin K shot, for example, when babies are born, which prevents bleeding, uncontrolled bleeding, often in the brain of babies. And it kind of relates to anti-vax because parents kind of think that the vitamin K shot is a vaccine. But this general distrust of authority that you guys are all familiar with is kind of runs rampant. And I think, you know, with the availability of information at people's fingertips and the Dunning-Kruger effect, et cetera, it can be a huge mess.
But Bob, what you were saying is like once you buy one baby-related item online, you get targeted and you're pegged as a parent. So now you actually can
targeted.
No, I know, but I'm saying in addition to what you're saying, then you also are a target for marketing everything towards a new parent, which includes a lot of the pseudoscience.
I read a very interesting article a few years ago. It was fascinating. And this is just pure marketing and science. And it was that somebody came up with an algorithm based on incidental things that you buy in the store, innocuous things, based on an algorithm that examined a few different things that you buy. If you buy these things, there's like, a 93% chance that you have just discovered that you are pregnant, which is valuable intelligence, because once you know that, then you start slamming them with ads in the mail, online, and that was the hook to get them so early that they're like, wow, how did you even know that I was pregnant? I haven't even told my husband yet or my family yet. And because of this algorithm, it was a real coup. They go, whoever came up with this algorithm nailed it. And it was like he's kind of famous in those circles. So it's even earlier than that. Before you even tell anyone, some people will know that, yes, you are most likely pregnant.
Did you hear that the same algorithm, I think it was Target stores, realized that this, I think a 16 or 17-year-old girl was pregnant based on her purchasing habits and sent some sort of new baby promotions to her parents. And her parents had no idea, and it was this huge, oh gosh, I really feel for that kid and for her parents, but it was true. She was pregnant and the algorithms worked really well.
Is that a violation of privacy, or is that like if you purchase stuff in a store, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy? That's an interesting question.
That's a good one. Yeah, I don't know.
I would think the latter.
Well, I would think, at this point, you just have to be a very well-informed consumer and be careful because, one erroneous thing like that, and you could be in a database, and then good luck trying to get yourself out of that database. Like I had my wife and I were like doing something about loan shopping online or whatever a couple of years ago, and my phone number ended up going into one of these sites. We're like, yeah, give us a call. Like, my wife was just doing stuff at night, accidentally. I don't want to really think that she was mindful about this because I'll just blame her for all of it. But I've gotten 5 phone calls a day since then, literally from numbers all across the United States because now they have these random phone number generator things.
Me too, Jay.
So I virtually don't pick up my phone anymore unless it's someone I know. If it's an unknown number, I'm not picking it up. That's just my rule now.
I really don't think those do not call lists don't work, do they? Have any of you guys looked into this?
Well, I think what happens is they wind up putting you on multiple lists. So yes, you can say, take me off this list, but what about the other 9 lists that you were simultaneously put on at the same time? Those numbers are going to call you and you have to get through that whole thing. So
Jay, that same thing happened to me, dude. In the past year and a half, I get calls from Maryland, from blah, from cities I never even heard of. I'm like, and then when I see them, I'm like, yep, I'm not going to pick that up. But they found a number in Danbury, and that's
And when
I see that, I'm like, well, crap, I got to pick that up. And then this very perky girl says, hi, congratulations. And then I hang up.
I'm
like, oh my God.
But Bob, you just won a cruise or something.
Oh, geez.
Isn't that true? It's like, yeah, it's this perky girl. I got called by like the same one 3 times in a week, and she pulled the same bit on me every time.
Well, it's
a recording.
No, Jake.
This one wasn't
a recording. It was a live person.
It's a meat voice? Wow.
Well, they're robocalling, right?
Then meat voice, Bob.
When you answer the phone.
I just made that up.
Hang on.
It's yours.
When you answer the phone, she's like, oh, sorry. I just had to, my headphones were not on straight, Because there's a delay in her answering you because she's going monitoring robocalls. So she then tries to cover for the delay by pretending like her headphones had slipped off. But she did the same exact bit to me, every time she called. I always just immediately hung up.
Yeah, but what about the ones I was referring to, Steve, where they have figured out a very normal delay? So like, hey, how you doing? And you're like, oh, hi. And the recording knows what the delay should be, what a typical response would be. And what's funny is years ago, a friend of mine at work, he found like this prank call app that has these pre-recorded things where the app calls the person with the recording and it records the conversation. And we were pranking people like crazy from work with this thing. And it worked like a charm. It worked amazingly well. And now these telemarketers use those, perfectly timed apps to try to get you to click into the next, menu or whatever, make a decision that you normally wouldn't do.
Oh, boy.
It's always so embarrassing, like when you're by yourself and you think it's a meat voice and you're talking to them and there's no one there.
Bob, like how does it feel to make up prank. A term and have it used 3 minutes later? How does that feel, it. Man?
I
That's
love
awesome.
It.
Copyright it quick.
I want to see Colbert say it, though.
Yeah. My new phone, when I get a spam call, it says, I get like a red screen, that this is likely a spam call.
Ooh,
so
really?
I just, yeah, and, nice. And I've checked it out a few times, and it was right 100% of the time. So I'm going to go with that. I get the red screen, not going to answer it. So you need to fight back with the same technology, the same awesome. Algorithms.
Yeah, until AI gets more advanced, comes along, and they wind up cheating the whole system, and you won't know who the hell you're talking to, robot or person.
Yeah, that's true. All right, Bob, you're going to start us off with a Forgotten Superheroes of Science.
Yes, for this week's Superheroes of Science, or Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Virginia Apgar, 1909 to 1974. She was an anesthesiologist and the first woman to become a full professor at Columbia University. She also developed the famous Apgar score for evaluating newborns. Steve, I'm sure you're very familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, but Bob, if she had something named after her, how forgotten is she?
That's true.
I had no idea that the Apgar score was named after her.
There you go. There you go.
All right.
And also,
sorry.
And also,
it's been turned.
It's been her. Her name has been turned into a backronym. Have you ever heard of a backronym? They actually turned the letters of her name into an acronym. So that makes it even less, you know, likely that you think it's an.
What does it stand
person.
For?
So, well, just one of the things that I'm going to talk about. You know, respiration. Heart rate, muscle tone,
P,
grimace.
P is pulse.
You know, of course.
P is pulse for sure. I'm pretty sure.
Yes, yeah.
Appearance, pulse, grimace, activity, and respiration.
Right.
Apgar entered the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University just before the Wall Street crash in October 1929, which was, of course, the beginning of the Great Depression. So yet, despite financial issues, she graduated fourth in her class in 1933. Now, at that time, I didn't notice, anesthesiology was not considered the specialty as it is today until the 40s. I think nurses pretty much did it back then, and it wasn't really, you know, fully studied like other specialties in school. But in 1949, when that type of research became an actual academic department at Columbia, Apgar became the first woman full professor at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, very first one. So she started soon specializing in obstetrical anesthesia, which focuses on the effects of its effects during labor on the baby. So what she did, one of the things that she, what she of course is known for, she designed the first standardized method for evaluating a baby that's newborn within, say, a minute to 10 minutes. And that's what the Apgar, that's the essence of the Apgar test. So this is a methodical way to assess a baby's transition to life outside the womb, essentially. So each of the following are given 0, 1, or 2 points: heart rate, respiratory effort, muscle tone, and reflex response. 10 is the perfect score. And in my limited understanding, babies do not get 10. And it's funny because I remember years ago when my daughter was born, talking with the nurses, the only babies that ever get a 10 are the babies of doctors that work at the hospital because they're trying to suck up a little to the doctor. So yeah, your baby got a 10. But you know, 8, 9 are wonderful, and that's what a lot of kids get. And that means everything is going very well. So this method was introduced at a science meeting in 1952. And of course, it was resisted a little bit initially. That didn't say really why it was resisted, but I've got some theories. But it quickly became a standard test used around the world. Now, this very simple scoring method reduced infant mortality and was essentially the foundation of neonatology. It pretty much started right then. And Apgar was also a leader in teratology, which is, Steve?
That's like abnormal
the
growth.
The tarot cards.
The study of birth
effects, which kind of makes sense because when you're looking at hundreds and thousands of kids, babies, and doing the Apgar test and refining the Apgar, you're also coming across a lot of these abnormalities that babies are born with. So she kind of like learned that hand in hand with developing Apgar, and she became a leader in teratology as well because of that. And I love this saying that I came across that many in the field have about Apgar. It said that every baby born in a modern hospital anywhere in the world is looked at first through the eyes of Dr. Virginia Apgar. And in a lot of ways, that's really true.
That's cool.
I really like that. So remember Virginia Apgar. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing circumduction or dorsiflexion or even perhaps acrocyanosis.
Dorsiflexion?
Yeah, baby.
Dorsiflexion.
That's a cool word.
Yeah.
It means to lift your foot up.
Why don't you just say lift your foot up then?
Well, it's like you're extending the foot at the ankle.
Yeah.
You know, upward. So the both actions are actually flexion. So you have to have dorsiflexion and plantar flexion.
Yes.
Because otherwise you can't distinguish them because they're both technically flexion.
Yeah. That's just doctors making up complicated words for no reason.
Right, for precision.
For precision. Okay, Yes. Sorry. Yes, of course.
All right, thanks, Bob. All right, so Coven, you write on your Forbes column a lot about organic farming and GMOs, which are also two of my favorite topics. So tell us about this article you wrote about misleading organic propaganda.
Yeah, so this is an update to a story. Some of you may recall a viral video from 2015 called The Organic Effect, which presented results from an experiment on a Swedish family. What happened was the Coop chain of grocery stores, known as a pioneer for organic food in Sweden, conducted an experiment on a family of five for 3 weeks. Like so many families on a tight budget, they ate a conventional diet to keep food costs down. In the experiment, they switched from a conventional diet to organic for 2 weeks, giving daily urine samples. The video showed that before switching to organic, their urine contained pesticides, fungicides, and other agricultural chemicals. And after eating an all-organic diet for 2 weeks, the ag chemicals were drastically reduced or no longer there. The video and accompanying infographics caused a frenzy worldwide and was widely covered by media despite being based on a totally flawed premise, which I'll get into in a moment. So last year, the Swedish Crop Protection Association sued Coop for inaccurate advertisement. Hearings took place just a few weeks ago now in the Stockholm District Court, and a judgment is expected on July 3rd. The association, the Swedish Crop Protection Association, consists of 9 separate companies that produce pesticides, and it called the Organic Effect campaign unethical, illegal, and rigged. They called for Coop to either stop using the misleading advertisement or face a penalty payment of 2 million Swedish crowns. That's about $240,000. Interestingly enough, the original video was taken down sometime in the last few weeks and replaced with a shorter, less inflammatory version. And while it's true that the Swedish Crop Protection Association serves corporate interests, they have a really good point. Consider the narrative that the video paints. A family of five goes from being full of toxic pesticides to immaculate urine in just 2 weeks. Telling parents that their kids' bodies are full of agrochemicals and that the solution is switching to organic is a pretty powerful motivator. But there's a huge red flag that those with some knowledge about agriculture would see right away, but that the average consumer may not realize. The experiment didn't test for chemicals used in organic farming. Though organic farming on any significant scale does use herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, and other agrochemicals, it's no surprise that a lot of people think organic farming doesn't use these chemicals. A 2014 organic marketing report from Academics Review suggests that the growth of the organic market worldwide is fueled in part by misleading information about conventionally and organically grown food, including the sometimes weaselly wordplay that implies or sometimes even outright claims falsely that organic farming doesn't use pesticides or is better for health or the environment. Sure, you know, the agricultural chemicals approved for use in organic farming tend to be naturally derived, but as we know, whether a substance is naturally occurring or synthetic, in and of itself, has no bearing on the toxicity to humans, on environmental impact, or anything else, really. So basically, the results of the experiment showed pretty much what we would expect when dropping conventionally grown food, that the levels of pesticides used in conventional farming practically disappeared from the family's urine.
Yeah, but they didn't measure like copper sulfate. Or,
right. So the video conveniently left out that it didn't test for chemicals used in organic farming and ignored that the detective levels of agrochemicals used in conventional farming in that experiment, I mean, they pose no known risk. they're way, way below the acceptable intake threshold set by pretty much any government. And the tiny sample size is, I mean, this is a family of five we're talking about, which renders the results practically kind of pointless. But again, when you're presented with this kind of video with these drastic sort of results, then it's pretty compelling.
So did they leave them out deliberately?
Of course.
Or,
right. I mean,
well, yeah.
I want to say they did. Like I mentioned, the organic marketing report, it's pretty clear and demonstrable at this point that there are a lot of deliberate omissions at best, and falsehoods at worst, that kind of drive growth in the organic industry. So in this situation, I thought it was kind of refreshing. Again, even though that this is a association of pesticide companies, it was still refreshing that they're kind of standing up against this misinformation. Hearings happened now in mid-May, and I've been following it closely. Before I go into the current status, there have been some details that have come up. I should mention that most of the coverage in the last several months on this case have been in Swedish. So Emil Carlson of the Debunking Denialism blog and Ida Rochalme of the Thoughtscapism blog were kind enough to translate some of it for me. So I have to give them some props for that. The defense lawyer for Coop went with three main arguments. One was that the report and corresponding video were not really marketing per se, and therefore they want to say that it's qualifying as protected speech.
Oh, that's crap.
Right. So they're
I mean, that's like the very definition of marketing. Are you kidding me?
It's pretty much marketing. I mean, their legal strategy is to call the video, loosely translated here, but their strategy is to call it something like public opinion advocacy or consumer information rather than advertising or marketing. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely marketing. And they also want to argue that the intent for the video was to convey information that consumers could easily understand. Again, presumably they're trying to argue that this isn't quite misinformation, but it seems like a stretch to me. And I mean, from the court documents that I've seen, unfortunately, it appears that even if their arguments aren't substantiated, they could be pretty convincing to someone that doesn't really understand these issues so well. But one fun thing that skeptic foodies might enjoy is that lawyers for the Swedish Crop Protection Association brought out that iconic infographic of the ingredients list of the all-natural strawberry. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the series of infographics by a chemistry teacher that kind of break down all of the hard-to-pronounce components of whole foods, like all-natural bananas and cherries. But in any case, I'm kind of on the edge of my seat for the initial judgment. And I spoke with the director of the Swedish Crop Protection Association, and he seems hopeful. So we'll see. There's going to be a judgment apparently on July 3rd.
So that's interesting because from my perspective, that's like the entire strategy of the organic food lobby, which is to fearmonger about their industrial competition, right? This is one business essentially slandering their competitors, and they're selling it like this is just consumer information. This is advocacy. This is opinion. But in actuality, no, you are trashing your competition with misinformation and pseudoscience. And this one court case is sort of encapsulating this larger strategy of the organic food lobby.
Yeah, this is definitely representative of this larger strategy. And that's why I kind of find it so refreshing and why I'm following it so closely. I mean, it's rampant, this strategy of misleading people, especially in a kind of saturated market of when we have a food supply that's really the safest and most abundant and varied that we've ever had. I mean, what else are these people going to do? They have to differentiate their products or their industry in a seemingly meaningful way.
And justify an increase in price.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, there's what other way do they have to justify it? If you're telling people that, okay, your conventional diet could hurt you, but you know, if you just make a sacrifice of a little bit of your budget and you're going to be so much safer and healthier, then of course, you know, parents especially are going to make those sacrifices, even if they end up ultimately being unnecessary.
Yeah, which gets us back to the parent shaming strategy as well. And in addition, they basically turn their customers into their proponents, right? So you have people who are organic advocates. They are customers of organic food, but they also spread misinformation, you know, about organic and versus conventional farming, the competition, because they've been misinformed. They've been given information that they didn't realize they were watching a commercial. They thought they were watching consumer information. They're misinformed. They buy the product and they become proponents of the product as well. In a way, it's brilliant, you know, as a marketing strategy.
It's
think
totally
about
brilliant.
It.
Sinister,
I mean,
kind
it's
of way.
Sinister, but it's, I mean, it's fascinating at the same time. And yeah, I mean, that the very targets of this marketing become their proponents is so obvious. I mean, speaking of public misunderstanding of agriculture, you hear a lot of people talking about Food Inc. and GMO OMG and genetic roulette. And a lot of people are getting their information and their misinformation even from Netflix and from documentaries. So I want to give a shout out to a movie, an upcoming movie that releases on Friday called The Food Evolution Movie. It's the first feature-length film that takes a science-based look at the GMO debate, and it's directed by Oscar-nominated filmmaker Scott Hamilton Kennedy and narrated by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I should mention that I appear in the film in footage of my group's 2015 counter-protest against a specific large anti-GMO, anti-vaccine, anti-fluoride group that some of you guys may be familiar with. I guess I won't name them out of courtesy. But it's particularly important, this movie, given that until now, I'd say every other documentary that discussed genetic engineering has relied heavily on anti-GMO scare tactics.
Yeah, which just became part of their marketing campaign. Again, it's worked remarkably well. Although, what's your sense? So, you know, as a, you know, someone who's communicating on this topic, my sense is that maybe we're starting to make a little bit of headway. Although, you know, you have to start within the group of science enthusiasts and skeptics to begin with. I mean, if you go back even just 3 years, I would say most skeptics thought that there was something wrong with GMOs. They weren't safe.
Well, there were definitely skeptics talking about it.
Even some prominent skeptics.
I think it's still, mm-hmm. I think it's still a blind spot for skeptics who even, you know, skeptics who realize that genetic engineering may be as safe as any other breeding technique. But a lot of us skeptics, I mean, conflate it with these sort of nebulous but justified concerns like corporate control of food supply, monoculture, pesticide use, and the transformation of life into intellectual property. And I agree that we're slowly turning the tides, but there's a lot of that leftover effect from a couple years ago that are now still so prevalent. So like, for example, the proliferation of the non-GMO project label that we see in grocery stores, it's kind of hitting the high point now. It's all around us. If you go to a grocery store, it's everywhere. And so we still have that effect to kind of combat right now, even if awareness is rising.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think once people start to go down that road, like let's say that you have this feeling that, you know, GMOs are bad and you're reading things. And of course, you know, now you're reinforcing that initial belief by finding articles that agree with what you already think, and you're spending more money on organic food and all that. And then one day you read an article that trashes organic food. Now think about what's going on in the average person's mind. Like unconsciously they're thinking, man, have I been wrong all this time? Have I spent all this extra money that I didn't need to? And they'll just emotionally double and triple and quadruple down to stay in that zone where they don't feel like they were being ripped off this whole time. And it just reinforces itself. It propagates itself.
Yeah, but it's so easy to go for the corporate shill card. You know,
that's right. I mean, and this movie's already getting it. It's almost like a reality TV show. If you go on Twitter and just look up food evolution, there's all this arguing going on from both extreme sides, black and white sides, like this dichotomous thinking about food and agriculture at each other's throats as this movie is about to come out, because this is going to be the first movie that makes a kind of science-based impact on this discussion, at least when it comes to movies. And I hope people will just watch it and let the movie speak for itself, because the rhetoric right now is, it's pretty polarized.
So it is interesting to me, within the skeptical community, within scientists, people who should know better, how effective the propaganda has been in that, as you say, once you say, all right, listen, the scientific evidence shows there's no health risk for GMO and there's no environmental risk and the process itself is inherently fine and well regulated. But they don't want to let go of the anti-GMO position because whatever, it just resonates with them ideologically, or they just like the whole clean eating thing. They've sort of just bought a little bit too much into that.
And oh, it's a sacred cow. No,
yeah, they migrate over to these more subtle issues like, well, I don't believe in patenting life. It's like, right. Okay, let's explore that issue a little bit more deeply. Yeah. First of all, it has nothing to do with GMOs directly. And, you know, seeds and have been patented for 100 years, you know, so you should therefore be against all hybrid seeds, basically every type of apple that's out there.
Pretty much, you know, most every commercially food, yeah. grown crop or food. But it's, yeah. I mean, it's understandable. It really is a sacred cow, though. I mean, the co-founder of my activist organization, March Against Myths, we fight against what we call pseudoscience and justice. David Sutherland, he is a animal rights activist and a vegan, and he has this group called Vegan GMO, and all vegans, I'm not sure if you're aware, kind of tend to fall into this anti-GMO pool. I happened to try to go shopping for tofu the other day, and I have a pretty good grocery selection, like 20 different types of tofu, and not one of them wasn't non-GMO project verified or otherwise had a non-GMO label. And I'm talking to Dave and he's like, yeah, there is literally not one tofu that I've found in all of Chicago where I live that doesn't have this. Like, we just, as vegans, all assume that this is harmful.
But we'll keep plugging away.
Yep. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Jay, maybe we'll just go to Mars.
But we need GMOs on Mars.
Yes, oh, yeah. We do.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah. Well, I know where Steve's heading. So Steve wants me to talk about how Stephen Hawking loves the end of the world, because that's all he's been talking about lately, right? Stephen Hawking was at a science and art festival in Norway, and this is called Starmus. This was June 20th of this month, and he had some profound comments about the future of humanity. In fact, I didn't know this. He's been making a lot of statements about the survival of humanity and what we need to do to make it past these serious events. I just didn't know to what degree Hawking was doing this, but it is, you know, quite common for him to talk about this. He's even making a documentary film for the BBC about how humans will soon need to leave the Earth and colonize other worlds. This is a strategy to get past one of these several serious events that could take place. And I don't really disagree. I mean, you know, here's the list of things that could potentially happen. And it really isn't a if, it's more of a when on some of these. One, obviously, an asteroid strike. It's going to happen, really. It's just, guys, statistically, just a matter of time. Now, he's saying a pandemic. Yep, you know, there could be a worldwide disease. Absolutely. He also said that it could be, you know, something like a genetically engineered virus that scientists make to actually do something good, but it turns out to be doing something that was unpredictable and very, very bad. War, you know, different levels of war could do this, especially the bomb. You know, these are all possible, and they all could have a significant impact on humanity's future and compromise humanity's future.
Does he mention a coronal mass ejection?
He specifically didn't, Bob. No, I have no idea. He didn't. I didn't read that.
Maybe because that doesn't like kill outright, but that's one of the things I'm most afraid of.
Well, Bob, yeah, think about it. I mean, that could fry the grid on whatever side of the planet happens to be facing the sun, or if it lasts long enough to fry the whole planet. But that's, to me, that's an end game. You know, that would stop everything. And what would humanity be like after that? We would be doing a major reboot at that point. But I agree.
Oh, yeah, that's, man. It's nasty.
That should be on the list.
And so likely it's scary. Steve, yeah. what were those odds? Like 12% in the next 10 years or something crazy. It's like, damn.
Yeah, it's like it's definitely going to happen within the next you know, 50 years, 60 years, like 80, 90%. It's just a question of how big is it going to be, you know?
Yeah, if good it's thing we're hardening like a, our system, right, Steve?
Yeah, like, right, which we're not.
Oh, yeah, right, which
no,
we're not.
No one's making a move on it.
And, I mean, we had the event in the 1800s. It was the Carrington event. Luckily, there was...
18, yeah,
1850s. Yeah, there weren't too many electronics around to do... to nobody really cared. But if it happened today...
Bob, that was so long ago. Who cares? Yeah. Whatever. So anyway, to keep going here... Hawking and Elon Musk agree that we should be setting our sights on colonizing Mars and other planets. And to hedge our bets, you know, we need to make a move now because it's going to take a long time to develop the technology. You know, I'm sure I know Elon Musk has a plan that is relatively soon, but let's face it. There's a lot of technology we're going to need that we don't have. And in order to do it really well, we're going to need a lot more of a sophisticated level of technology. And these things take, you know, time and money that we have to start now in order to reach it soon enough to dodge a lot of these bullets that Hawking thinks is out there. Now, here's a recent quote that he said. I am arguing for the future of humanity and a long-term strategy to achieve this. He goes on, there is no new world, no utopia around the corner. We are running out of space, and the only places to go to are other worlds. So, of course, Mars is nice and convenient because it's in our solar system. It's close. It's a relatively known planet. It's a good starting point. You know, we know that there's ice and or water there, and we know enough about the regolith to be able to figure out things that we could make out of the soil there. It has a magnetic field.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, kind of spotty, yeah, and lame.
It has a lame local magnetic fields that
it's
are
very weak.
Are not. There's not a planet-wide magnetic field. That's a problem.
It doesn't offer protection the way the Earth's
very little
offers.
Not by much, Jay. It really isn't.
Not by much.
Well, a little is better than nothing, Steve. Lesson learned. So we really do. I think now going to a personal opinion. I think that's an interesting idea. I totally think that it's inevitable anyway that humanity is going to do something like this. And if we're going to do it, then why not make it part of a strategy to help our survival? And now think about this, guys. Proxima Centauri, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's one. Been there. It's 4.5 light years from Earth.
Oh.
Now that's crazy far. It's close. It sounds close, well, right, Coven?
Yeah.
But it's just
a little skip, hop, and a jump.
It seems like that. Now, I don't want to be a naysayer. It's far. It's really far. It's 30 trillion miles or 48 trillion kilometers.
Roughly, yeah.
But it's not that far. And, you know, that's a viable system. We think that we know of at least one planet in the system that we think has a potential. So think about how long it would take, guys, if we started now to develop the technology. Now, Hawking was talking about sending those tiny little nano droids out there to just give us some intel on the planet. You know, we're talking 25, 30 years before we would have any legitimate data to make a decision to do something like that. So there's long-term strategies here that we'd have to consider right now in order to make some of these decisions. Now, the other side of the coin, and we should be doing this anyway, of course. Yeah, we got to start talking about maintaining this planet, okay? Mm-hmm. So we have this massive anti-GMO sentiment going on right now. Please, you know, anybody that's reading the legitimate literature knows we need GMO.
Yeah.
We need to be, right? We have to be careful about what technologies we are, you know, we have these.
If you really want sustainability, you got to look at everything, you know, with scrutiny and not just dismiss something because you think it's bad for the environment. When it could really help with carbon sequestration and be a tool. I mean, we got to take advantage of all these tools. I'm just, you know, I'll go on forever about this, but come on, let's take what we have.
The ironic situation is if you are pro-organic anti-GMO, then you don't realize this, but you are anti-environment and you want to kill poor children. Unfortunately, that's what it results in. And of course, they don't realize that it does. But
when we say this, people are like, "Oh yeah, sure, you're going with that narrative." And going back to the movie again, it's like, "Oh, we're going with saving the poor kids narrative." That's reaching, and you're like, "No, it's really not reaching."
It's actually really true. Golden rice, hello.
I mean, that's the perfect example.
And there's others as well. It's not just the golden rice. There are staple crops in poor parts of the world
banana,
that are threatened by fungus.
Well,
the banana.
Huge.
Yeah.
I think a lot of this, I'm hoping that they have a breakthrough with GMO where they create plants that could fixate nitrogen and up their photosynthesis, that it's going to be such a slam dunk, or the organic movement will fight it. But when people see the effect of plants that have been GMO to do that, it's going to be like, holy crap. I mean, yeah, that causes a sea change.
In my opinion, if we could just get a PPO silenced non-browning avocado, like, everybody would be on board. Like, all the avocado toast people. I know, right? You know, if you could just get a non-browning avocado, then we can do all of the other more important engineering and people will be happy eating their green avocado. Whatever it takes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, but that, you know, you're not too far from the truth. If the GMO science community, you know, maybe they should really think, like, we got to market a couple of products that are going to blow away
for the farmer, but for the consumer, because they went first.
For the anti-GMO consumer that might really change their mind, like, look at this. How can you turn this delicious thing down? I don't know. It's something along those lines.
Tear-free onion.
All right. Now, Jay, so I like, you know, where you're turning, though, towards, I sort of half agree or partly agree with Hawking. I think the notion that we, like, need to be able to move to another planet is silly. We need to sustain and protect this one. Otherwise, we're just going to go to a new world and destroy that one. I mean,
well, that's where I was going with this.
Yeah, I know.
That's the other side of the coin. I mean, we really need, first, come on, obviously, guys, global warming, it's here. You know, the U.S. government is not even acknowledging it at this point. Like, we're not even doing the things that should be relatively easy to accept, not to fix, but, you know, if we can't get people to nod their head towards, yep, global warming is happening, we're in big trouble. And I honestly feel that I've been a skeptical activist for, what, 25 years now? I've been doing this podcast for 11 years.
12.
You know, or 12 years now. It's depressing, guys. You know, I feel like we're in a very difficult 50-year
cycle. Just think how bad it would be if we weren't doing this. Just keep
that. Yeah, that's the thing we could never measure, and I hear what you're
saying,
Steven.
Yeah,
they got a whole lot of something.
25 years, you're the most discouraged now. Would you say that?
I'm not discouraged.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, there's a lot of good things. I mean, this is a big topic. There's so many good things that we've done. I mean, I can bring up a lot of great successes and all that. But overall, culturally, there's been such an anti-science movement. It's alive. It's there. It's never been this palpable before that I can remember. And I'm including history, you know, me reading U.S. and world history, the anti-science sentiment. I mean, it's pretty bad for it to be where it is right now. I mean, you could legitimately say that the average person lost their love for science.
No, I don't think that's true at all. They're just being sold pseudoscience. That's the problem, is that they're...
And they're having a hard time determining...
Exactly. What's the difference, Steve? What's the difference?
But people love science, and they respect scientists, they respect science, but they just get confused about what's real science. The problem is there's too much fake shit out there.
I don't know. But, I don't know if people respect scientists. I don't know. I would disagree
with
Coven. That.
If you survey, in surveys, they're still ranked among the most respected profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's just the data.
Yeah, I guess maybe people answer that way in surveys, but when you just talk to people, we got to take the data. So you're right there, but gosh, people have these perceptions of scientists that I think are completely unreal.
No, but the data also shows that that's only true on topics that they're emotionally invested in. So don't be overly affected by that. On topics that people don't have a political, ideological, emotional stake, they love science and love scientists.
Good.
It's fine. But when you turn to something about which they're emotionally invested, then they're willing to turn on a dime and invoke conspiracies, and those scientists are bad. The other scientists are fine. So it's not about the science, though. It's about the emotionally held ideological belief. That's what all the data shows. And I think it's important that we don't confuse those two things. It's not a generic disrespect for science. It's a targeted disrespect for science that is against your closely held belief.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I will always bow down to the data, but the aggregate result here, the end result that I'm detecting is the science ignorance is high, and there is a fear of science and a threat from science.
Yeah,
now
but
that,
science literacy has been increasing over the last 25 years. Jay, I'm just telling you the data. There's a lot of confirmation bias. I'm with you on it. I'm just telling you, there's a lot of confirmation bias in doing what we're doing because we're in the trenches on social media talking to conspiracy theorists and pseudoscientists. We're confronting it. And so it could very easily seem like everything is going downhill. But the data is actually not as bad as our, you know, perceptions.
I'm gonna turn around and say, I understand what you're saying now because while scientific literacy goes up, I think emotions are becoming even more and more integral, at least with specific topics with people, becoming more influential. So yes, that's perceptible.
Let me give you also my perception of the last 25 years. So I think that if you think back, Jay, for 20, 25 years, 15 years, what we were talking about, we were talking about astrology and a lot of UFOs,
Bigfoot
and ghosts. You know, stuff that, you know, that was we were cutting our critical thinking, you know, science communication teeth. But who gives a crap about those topics? To be honest with you, like who somebody believes in ghosts, who really cares? But what was important was critical thinking and understanding how science works. Now we are dealing with GMOs and vaccines and global warming and really important issues. And I think the skeptical community in aggregate has a really important skill set, an understanding of science and critical thinking and how to communicate it. We're fighting a huge fight against overwhelming forces, but I think that we have evolved a lot. Think about how much more we all know now than we did those 25 years ago and much more sophisticated we are in our science advocacy. And I'll tell you something else. The scientific community, while they're behind the times, there's some of them understand what's going on, and they're doing research which is showing in what we've been talking about all along, but is showing it now in experimental detail. So we have a lot more scientific backing for the broad concepts of science versus pseudoscience and critical thinking that we've been talking about for 25 years. I think the next step that we need to move to, because we're making ground on science literacy, I think, but what we really need now is to incorporate critical thinking more seamlessly with science communication. And I think that we're making headway there too. You know, how many people know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is? It's a start, you know, and think about just the existence of the Dunning-Kruger effect. 25 years ago, we didn't have that in our bag. Now we do.
Yeah.
Along
true.
With 100 other things. So I think,
But there's a downside too, Steve. I mean, there's a dark half of this conversation. That is the internet is, in my opinion, kind of backfired.
Well, it's both. It's a double-edged sword.
It is. But the propagation of pseudoscience is profound now. I mean, it's at everybody's fingertips, and the information spreads so quickly. It's instantaneous at this point, and I worry. I really do worry. I hope we are going to continue on this upward trend that you're saying. But you're right, Steve. It's an interesting perspective because my attitude has been like we are in the trenches to such a degree that sometimes I don't see the sun come up on some days because I'm like, what is going on out there? This world is so crazy now. It's depressing.
The trenches, especially in meat space, because we were talking about, what was it, Meat Voice earlier. But anyway, I've been in some of the trenches in meat space, like at these rallies, like these kind of pseudoscience rallies, and it's kind of like the who's who and all of the, you know, kind of deepest and darkest pseudoscience and misinformation based worldviews kind of amalgamating, and it's ugly. Like I think sometimes we forget, even data driven people like us forget to look at the data and see what's promising.
Yeah. Exactly. So just to close off the Hawking discussion, I agree we need to go to Mars because there are things that we can't defend the Earth against. Like we may get wiped out by a CME or
sharks,
an asteroid or whatever, a meteor hitting the planet. And it'd be nice to have
super volcano
to be not in have all our eggs in one basket. But I don't think it should be our solution to not taking care of our own world.
You can't shirk our responsibility to
the planet. With one caveat, the moon first, not Mars.
Moon
first.
Yeah, but that's a logistical point,
you guys.
Wisconsin, right?
Yep.
Jeez, the moon.
All right, guys, so did you hear about this European Union Court of Justice decision?
I read about it.
Yeah. What is going on? This is weird and crazy.
So it's not as crazy as you might think, and a lot of the headlines were hyped. So let me tell you what I see is actually going on here. So the case, I think everyone got their hackles up. Is that right, or is it shackles?
Yeah,
hackles.
Everyone got their hackles up because it had to do with a vaccine case. So that plaintiff is claiming that the hepatitis B vaccine triggered his multiple sclerosis, MS. So because it's vaccine related, then the tribes were already primed to go, right? But this has to do with the standard of scientific evidence in this case, European Union courts. And this comes from the Court of Justice of the European Union, which is their highest court.
Not to be confused with the League of Justice.
Right. I asked in my blog, is there any other kind of court? And somebody said, yeah, there's a Court of Human Rights. It's like, okay, so this is the Court of Human Rights as distinct from the Court of Justice.
And I was thinking, Court of Public Opinion, too.
Yeah, is there a Court of Injustice somewhere we need to know about? But
it does sound a little redundant.
Okay, so anyway, they released a decision, not a specific decision on this case, but sort of a guidance to this case. And the guidance is very, very problematic, in my opinion, and very naive in some very important ways. So here's the background. It's a little bit wonky, so bear with me. So the idea is, what is the threshold of evidence necessary for a plaintiff to meet their burden of proof that some product caused them harm, right?
4-for-1.
Mm-hmm. Now
– well said, Bob.
In these cases, if you say, hey, I used this product and it caused me this harm, you have the burden of proof to show that that is actually the case. So, and in this case, it's the product is the hepatitis V vaccine and the harm is it triggered multiple sclerosis. The traditional standard is that you have to show that scientifically that there's a cause and effect between the product and the harm, the alleged harm, right?
Reasonable.
That's what's changing. So the court ruling said, well, okay, plaintiffs still have to meet their burden of proof. However, in cases where there is an absence of definitive scientific evidence that there's a causal link between the product and the outcome, that the judges don't have to defer to scientific experts, that they can decide for themselves if there's a probable link between the product and the outcome based upon a number of criteria. And they said, for example, in a case of a disease, you can consider, is there a family history for the disease? What was the prior health status of the plaintiff? Is there a temporal association? And are there other cases where similar effects are being alleged?
Okay, that sounds like a reasonable approach.
It sounds reasonable because you don't understand medicine. It just like these judges, it superficially sounds reasonable, but it's actually terrible. And I'll explain to you exactly why. So think about it. What they're saying is that these factors, absence of a family history, prior healthy state, temporal association, that these are predictive, that these carry some predictive value. Now, as a diagnostician, we're used to thinking in terms of predictive value. And in fact, I teach my students, don't think about how typical a symptom is. Think about how predictive a symptom is, because that includes not only how typical, but how specific it is. And if you don't consider those two pieces of information, you get misled. You make the wrong diagnosis. So applying that here, what we really need to be asking is, how predictive is the absence of a family history for multiple sclerosis that the multiple sclerosis had a specific cause or trigger? And I would argue that the predictive value of that piece of information is practically zero. So about 15% of patients with multiple sclerosis have a family history, have a relative who has MS. There is a predisposition, but it's not an inherited disease, not a genetic disease. But that means that 85% of patients with MS do not have a family history. So what does it mean that somebody with MS doesn't have a family history?
Nothing.
Not much.
Really,
yeah.
Not much.
Okay.
Prior healthy state, that has zero predictive value, because most people who come up with MS are otherwise young, healthy people. Right? It doesn't occur in sick people. It doesn't occur in old people. Right? It occurs in young people. Most young people are, just statistically speaking, otherwise healthy. So what does it mean that he was not sick before he came down with his MS? Nothing. That has almost zero predictive value, right?
Mm-hmm.
The temporal sounds association. It sounds superficially plausible if
good,
you're
right.
not an expert. So these are right. non-experts saying we don't need experts, and here's why we don't need experts, and their reasons all show that they need experts because they're showing their naivete to clinical decision making in the very decision that they're using to argue that they don't need experts. It's Dunning-Kruger at the high court level.
Right. Yeah, what about Steve? When you read this, I was thinking more in terms of like just generally speaking for various any disease caused by any product. So
yeah, but that's the problem.
This is Parkinson's.
You can't think of it. The same thing would apply with Parkinson's. You don't need a family history. You don't have to be sick previously.
But I mean, so generally speaking, that's all worthless as well.
No, I mean, you have to go disease by disease.
Yes,
you have to know the disease. That's the point. You have to be an expert in that freaking disease to know if any of these things have any predictive value. Let's take the temporal association. So this guy got sick months after the vaccine and was diagnosed a year after he had the vaccine. So what's the next piece of information that you need to have? What is the delay? Right. If you're talking about an infection, there's an incubation period. But here you have to understand the pathophysiology of the disease well enough to understand what is the plausible delay from an inciting event and the development of signs or symptoms of the disease. Right. So in terms of vaccines causing MS, the answer is we don't know because there is no sign showing that vaccines cause MS. So we don't know. There's no information about it. Is a year plausible? Not really. So, you know, you could think theoretically about things that might, environmental triggers that might contribute to the development of MS. What we do know is that your environmental risk factors occur up to age 15. After age 15, the environmental risk factors don't determine your risk for MS.
Interesting. Huh.
So you need to get exposed when you're young. And there could be a 10, 15, 20, 30-year delay in developing MS.
Wow.
So,
what if you got sick and then you had the vaccine? Then the temporal relationship would be important.
Well, the temporal relationship could rule it out if it's impossible. But it doesn't help you that much the other way around.
Right.
And also, you could also think, what if it was a post-infectious syndrome? So again, there's no known post vaccine MS syndrome doesn't exist, so we're just making shit up. But if we think, okay, but we do know that there are post-infectious syndromes, and those delays tend to be 4 to 6 weeks. So it's like it's too long for that, and it's not long enough for environmental risk factors for MS. But the other factor here is that if there's a delay of months, even if it's plausible from a causal point of view, that's a lot of time. That's a long window for random shit to happen. Yeah. So that's like, I did this thing and 3 years later I came down with this disease. And okay, well, you know, that's data mining, right? That's like, in a way, that's an open-ended criteria. You have this huge delay. It's one thing if you got it 3 days later. That could still be a coincidence, but at least then the temporal association means something. If your temporal correlation is months later, which doesn't really even correspond to a plausible cause, what does that tell you? It tells you nothing. It really is of almost no predictive value whatsoever. So right there, the criteria that the judge is using just show they have no idea about clinical medicine and diagnosis. And then let's get to the final criteria, that there are other cases. So they're basically saying we can use anecdotal evidence in order to assume causation from correlation.
That's awful.
Right? That's what they're saying. So how do we know? Now, of course, once the notion gets out that A causes B, vaccine causes autism or whatever, then there are people who are going to self-select to present, yeah, as, oh, I have, my son has autism and he was vaccinated. It's not a scientific sampling. It's not a representative sample. It's a self-selected sample. It's confirmation bias.
Worthless.
So how do we know? How do we know if the correlation is real or not? You do freaking science. You have to do controlled systematic evaluation of data, epidemiological studies to know if a cluster is real or not. And so it gets back to you need experts to interpret actual science. And the notion that you could make any kind of conclusions based upon anecdote is, again, profoundly naive. So these are things that all superficially may sound good if you're not a medical expert. But if you know anything about diagnosis, and in this case MS, they make absolutely no sense. So here's the other thing. The application to this case is bizarre because we have lots of studies showing no correlation between any vaccine, the hepatitis B vaccine specifically, and MS specifically, or any autoimmune disease. There was a 2017 systematic review which had 62 studies showing vaccines had no correlation with MS. There's a 2011 review, a 2003 review, all showing the same thing. So we have basically two decades of research and, you know, 60 plus studies showing no correlation. Is that enough? What is enough? Is it definitive? No, nothing's 100%. You can't ever prove zero risk. You could only just say that it's less than the power of all the studies combined to detect the risk, which gets, again, a little bit wonky for a judge who may not be used to thinking about science. But why would they think that this is not enough? Why would they substitute anecdotal evidence for the recent systematic review of 62 studies showing no correlation? So it's really, really a bad precedent, a bad ruling. It really weakens the role of science in determining these cases. Now, I get their justification for it. What they're thinking is, okay, what if some poor person is harmed by a product, but the science isn't there? We don't have the science. It may take 20 years to find out that there's a correlation. So should this person suffer because the science hasn't been done? It's like, okay, but if you want to err on the side of the person harmed, I get that over the corporation. That's kind of an easy emotional call to make. That's fine. But I don't think that justifies lowering the standard of evidence. And I don't think that, you know, in this case is justified because the evidence is there. Because they're also simultaneously saying they're raising the bar and they're essentially saying that you have to prove there's no risk. So it does, even though they claim that it doesn't, I think it does in practice shift the burden of proof in a completely unacceptable way. Now, what we did in the United States, which I think is a perfect solution, despite the fact that the anti-vaccine loons criticize it, is we said, okay, we want to have our cake and eat it too. We want to err on the side of protecting consumers who may or may not have been harmed by a vaccine without watering down the scientific standard in the court and without punishing corporations who statistically speaking are probably innocent, you know, if we're talking about speculating about new scientifically unproven effects. So they made a vaccine court, and the vaccine court takes a tax on vaccines, pools that money together, and then has a really low threshold for paying out anybody who has who develops any problems after getting a vaccine. They don't even worry about the science. They don't worry about whether or not you can prove scientifically that it actually, the vaccine caused the illness. They just say, hey, we're all taking a risk here collectively as a society. So we're just going to give money to people who bad stuff happens to after they got a vaccine. You know, so that's fine. That's a good compromise all around. But the anti-vaxxers say, oh, it lets the industry off the hook. Well, too bad. Suck it up. You know, the system is designed to protect all of us consumers and they're paying the tax on it to pay the vaccine court payouts. And it doesn't hamstring science in the actual courts of law. And I think it's the best compromise all around if you're not a fanatic.
The companies that make the vaccines are not doing it for a profit.
Yeah, it's like they make almost no profit on vaccines, and physicians make no profit giving vaccines. It really isn't a big profit driver. In fact, the profit margins are so low that it wouldn't take many of these cases to basically drive them out of the business, which, of course, is what the anti-vaxxers want. They want to drive the pharmaceutical companies out of the vaccine business. So that's really why they're against this, because it keeps them from doing that. It keeps them from harassing corporations and driving them out of business with frivolous, unscientific lawsuits. So that's why they're whining. But this is actually the best, I think, protection all around. So the EU, I think, totally dropped the ball on this decision. It was terrible. It's not quite what the hyped headlines are saying, but if you drill down to the details, it actually is a very, very bad decision.
It's really discouraging, but I mean, don't you think that the point that you can't prove a total absence of risk, this might be one of the most stubborn misconceptions, I think, in the public when it comes to things like this.
I agree. No, there have been anti-vaxxers who like, we won't take a vaccine until you prove zero risk. Yeah, it doesn't exist. There's no proof of zero risk of anything ever anywhere in the universe. So you can't
drive to work.
Yeah, don't drive to work. That seatbelt, there's no zero risk for life, for anything.
Right. Your body could quantum tunnel into a wall. Sure, it's a quintillion to one, but it's possible.
You could lose your meat voice.
that homeopathic remedy might actually turn into medicine.
So what was I saying about being optimistic before?
Just move on.
All right.
All right. We're in America with our vaccine courts. They're in Europe. They'll have to deal with it.
Screw you guys.
Yeah, I was saying maybe the UK was onto something with their whole Brexit thing.
Oh.
Ooh, snap.
Damn.
Burn.
Evan.
Steve.
What's going on? There's some kind of solar eclipse happening this summer. What's happening?
Okay. Yesterday marked the first full day of summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And more importantly than that, we're just under 2 months away from our total solar eclipse. Yes, it is being dubbed the Great American Total Solar Eclipse. Okay. And it will darken skies all the way from Oregon to South Carolina, with the path of totality along a stretch of land 70 miles wide, totality for those people. And the people who will descend upon that path of totality are in for a unforgettable experience. And I will be one of those people. It will take place on Monday, August 21st, 2017. And the moon will completely cover the sun and we'll be looking at the corona. Nice. But what else will we see? What's the experience like? I've never been. Folks who have put together a really good website called eclipse2017.org, they describe it as indescribable. However, they do give it a try. Here are a few highlights.
Inconceivable.
Here are a few highlights that they're trying to describe it as best as they can. The sky surrounding the sun will grow very dark very quickly. In real time, you will be able to see the deep blue turn to twilight blue and then to bluish black. Stars and planets, yes, four planets will be visible in the sky that day. The stars and planets will pop out of nowhere. Roosters and crows and insects will chirp as though night is falling. If you look to the west, you'll see a beautiful black curtain rising up out of the earth with hints of sunset orange north and south of it. While off to the east, the sky at the horizon is still rather light. On the ground, your shadow will become impossibly clear and thin, and then will vanish completely as the sun's light fades to about the intensity of the full moon. In the last few seconds before totality, that dull blackness you saw off to the west will suddenly spring up out of the earth and take over the whole sky like a gigantic curtain being pulled over you. If you aren't focused on the sun at that time, you'll be looking at the actual shadow of the moon racing towards you at supersonic speed, 3,400 miles per hour, and it's going to cover you in blackness. That's so cool. When you're in totality, you're looking at the most beautiful thing you're ever likely to see, the solar corona shimmering around the moon disk brilliantly. It will look to you as though someone has painted the sky a deep blue black and has cut an impossibly black hole in it with a pair of scissors and then smeared radiant, glowing, shimmering cotton candy around that hole.
And but then I thought, we can't look at it, though, can we?
You can for those couple of minutes that you are in actual totality.
All right, I think I got it. I think I got it. I don't need to go now.
That's right.
That
yes,
was a the indescribable pretty intense description.
It
that
was good.
Really
it was good.
Yeah.
It was good.
I became fascinated with solar eclipses when I was 9 years old. This was back in 1979. In that February, there was a total solar eclipse that touched North America. And here in Connecticut, we were going to be treated to about 70% of the eclipse. We weren't going to be in the path of totality, but it was a big deal. And I remember learning about what an eclipse was. This was our fourth grade class that year. We were all excited for it, all learning about it. We're pumped up. And the big day came.
Cloudy.
And it, yep, mostly cloudy.
That's regardless, what would happen to me. That's what would happen to me, for sure.
And hopefully it'll be a clear day, and hopefully I'll be able to see it in totality. So I asked my teacher, when's the next one? So they went to a book and looked it up.
Awesome.
2017 was going to be the next opportunity. What?
That's pretty much
never. Oh, gosh.
So when's the next one?
The next one after 2017 will be in 2024. And that one will have a south to north sort of trajectory for it, as opposed to a west to east trajectory. People like me are now getting ready. They're ordering their gear, their glasses, their binoculars, and telescopes and everything else, and all the filter equipment. That's happening right now. But people need to be careful because, well, I'll read it because Ted wrote me a nice letter about this, and I'll just read to you what he said. He said, I was alarmed by an ABC News report that some shipments of eclipse glasses from China were discovered to have inadequate filtering and were dangerous to view the sun with, despite having ISO and CE certification marks
hell?
On them. This scares me because millions of Americans will be looking at the sun on August 21st, and some may end up using substandard filters, especially children. Proper eclipse glasses filter out 100% of UV rays, 100% of infrared, and also filters 99.999% of visible light. NASA recommends four U.S. manufacturers of certified eclipse glasses, and they are American Paper Optics, Rainbow Symphony, Thousand Oaks Optical, and TSE-17. So there's your public service announcement from the Skeptics Guide for this episode, for the upcoming eclipse.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Are you guys ready to move on to science or fiction?
Oh, yeah.
Ready.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Okay, so there's three regular news items this week, no theme. You ready?
Let's go.
Ready.
Item number one, engineers at Caltech have created a flat camera that can focus light without a lens. Item number two, astronomers believe they have found evidence for yet another planet in our solar system, 60 AUs away from the sun and between the mass of Mars and Earth. And item number three, Australian scientists report a new method to convert atmospheric CO2 directly into a form of coal. All right, Coven, as our guest, you get to go first.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so engineers at Caltech have created a flat camera that can focus light without a lens. But nothing about this is sticking out to me here, except I'm wondering how light can be focused without any curvature. So that's my thinking right now on that one. Astronomers believe they have found evidence for yet another planet in our solar system, 60 AU away from the sun, and between the mass of Mars and the Earth.
So just for clarification, an AU is an astronomical unit, which is the distance, the average distance from the Earth to the sun.
Okay, the average distance from the Earth to the sun. 60 away from the sun and between the mass of Mars and the Earth. I mean, that just sounds plausible, but it would just be surprising to me that astronomers haven't detected that thus far. And then Australian scientists report a new method to convert atmospheric CO2 directly into a form of coal. It seems like with everything we can do at this point, that would be doable. I don't have a whole lot of concrete reasoning to determine why I think this is false, but I'm definitely between engineers at Caltech creating a flat camera that can focus light without a lens. That seems kind of iffy. And astronomers believing they have found evidence for yet another planet in our solar system between the mass of Mars and the Earth. I'm going to go with the discovery or found evidence of yet another planet in our solar system being the fiction.
You think that one's the fiction? Okay.
Yes.
Jay?
This first one here, engineers at Caltech have created a flat camera that can focus light without a lens. Out of the three of them, this one seems the most plausible to me. You know, you're thinking about the lens as the eye that the light passes through that's used to help focus that light onto something that reads the light. I would imagine, I mean, they could they be doing it all digitally? Like, could they be simulating it digitally? I think we can do that. And when they say flat, you know, that's the interesting word in the whole sentence there. Like, how flat is flat? Like, what do they mean? I mean, are they using anything to shine the light through? I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, and I just feel like it's, yeah, somebody figured out how to do it. I find that one cromulent. The next one, astronomers believe that they found evidence of another planet in our solar system. So it's 60 AUs away from the sun, and the planet is supposed to be between the mass of the Earth and Mars. Damn, that's interesting. I used to think that all the smaller planets had to be in close and only the bigger ones were out there, but you know, then you got Pluto out there and Pluto's like, ha-ha, so that blows that theory. I guess so. And then this last one here, the Australian scientists that report a new method to convert atmospheric CO2 directly into a form of coal, That one is very interesting. I mean, into a form of coal. So what do we say? What would be, I'm trying to think, when Steve says a form of coal, what form is he talking about?
Well, I'm just being, just to distinguish from the coal we dig out of the ground. It's not literal coal like we've been digging out of the ground, but it basically is coal.
Well, I think we can convert CO2 into a fuel. We can do that. I just don't know, like the whole thing about it being coal here is what's got me questioning it. So it's between the planet, 60 AU planet, and the coal for me. I will pick the coal as the fake.
Okay, Evan?
With the Caltech engineers and the flat camera focusing light without a lens, maybe they're doing it with the amazing magic of mirrors. Ooh, I don't know. That's just a guess. But I think that one is going to turn out to be science. Not sure about the mirror part, but we'll see. And then about the planet, a new planet, yet another planet, 60 AU away from the sun and between the mass of Mars and the Earth. Now, we already know that there is very likely a planet well beyond Pluto that we have not honed in on yet. So this would be another planet in addition to that planet. Hence, the way you worded this, found evidence for yet another planet. 60 AU away, that is far. Mass of Mars and the Earth, it is possible. Don't think I'm going to buy this one because, well, I'm going to say that this is something that I don't think would have escaped me in recent science news that I would have read. Because I look for these kinds of things. I am always, anytime I see exoplanet or anytime I see new planet, that's it. I stop. It's clickbait for me. And I didn't see anything about it. So that's kind of why I'm leaning on that one as the fiction. And then the last one about CO2 directly into a form of coal. The reason I don't think this one is fiction is because I've heard of scientists trying to turn CO2 or convert CO2 directly into several different things, some sort of liquid form. Another article I read earlier in the year had a country is working on turning it into a powder, like almost like a baking soda or something like that. So directly into a form of coal, yeah, I don't think that's implausible, at least the that they found a way to do it. So I think it's the planet. That's all I'm left with. I think that one's the fiction.
And Bob?
Yeah, the flat camera. Yeah, I mean, you don't need a lens necessarily to focus light. I mean, I don't think you're going to do it with a mirror or glass, but a special type perhaps, like a Fresnel lens, for example. It's got concentric rings of varying density material that could focus light, and it's fairly flat. Definitely not as thick as a lens. Yeah, but
this is not a flat lens. It's no lens.
No lens of ev at all.
That's what it says. No lens.
Yeah, but I mean, a Fresnel lens is, yeah, it's still a lens, but it's not a conventional lens. All right,
get over it.
Let me jump to number two. Yeah, I'm not buying number two either. They already know this. Already very confident that there's a planet, another one out there. So now this is yet another one, and not only that, but it's got a decent hunk of mass to it. Mars, between Mars and Earth, I'm not buying that. And like Evan, I think I definitely would have seen that. And then the third one, converting atmospheric CO2 to a form of coal. Yeah, I mean, that sounds totally plausible. Be very cool. I mean, I wish it wasn't, wish it was something better than, I mean, what are we going to do with the coal? We're not going to burn it. But hey, at least you're sequestering it. I mean, that's fine. The planet one would be a surprise. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
All right, so Jay, you're by yourself with the CO2. Everyone else thinks the planet one is the fiction. You all agree on the first one. So we'll start there. Engineers at Caltech have created a flat camera that can focus light without a lens. You all think this one is science, although Bob was a little confused about that. And this one is...
It's a Fresnel.
Science. This one is science.
Of course it is.
Yeah. It's hard to go wrong with these kind of tech ones. So... what they do, instead of a lens, they use what's called an optical phased array,
or
an OPA. Yeah, so it's an ultra thin thing, right? So, did you know that the camera is what is the limiting factor on the thinness of your smartphone?
Of course, yeah, so, that's one of the biggest reasons. Absolutely.
Yeah, so this would blow through that limitation. If they could, they have to develop this into a high resolution. Right now, their resolution is 8x8 pixels. So it's not very big. But, so how it works is, the OPA has a large array of light receivers, each of which can individually add a tightly controlled time delay to the light that it receives. So that causes a phase shift. And it can use that phase shift, just basically using a computer to program what the phase shift you want, and that can make the OPA essentially look in different directions and at different distances. So you could basically focus on different things by just tweaking the time delay in the sensor. So they found a way to focus light without a lens, which is great. So now all they have to do is just make it just scale it up to actually usable camera.
Yeah, 64x64 pixels. That'd be nice.
So yeah, this could be seeing these things, in 5 to 10 years, right? The usual 5 to 10 years. Very cool. Okay, let's go on. I guess we'll might as well take these in order. Astronomers believe they have found evidence for yet another planet in our solar system, 60 AU away from the sun and between the mass of Mars and the Earth. Jay, you think this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is the fiction. And this one is science. Good job, Jay.
Nice.
This one is cool. I love it when I hit upon these awesome news items that are just out. Yeah, so 60 AU is in the Kuiper Belt, right? But it's very close, right? So Neptune, for reference, is 30 AU away. So this is twice the distance to Neptune. But still, that's not far. Planet 9, which is a different thing, is hundreds of AUs away, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this would be a lot closer. Planet 9 is also maybe 10 times the mass of Earth. This is between, they think it's like Mars, but could be anywhere between Mars and the Earth and its mass. So how do they know? What's the evidence? Obviously, they haven't seen it directly, just like with Planet 9. They haven't seen it directly, but they are seeing the evidence of its gravitational force. So Kuiper Belt objects, Bob, are warped. There's a warp in the Kuiper Belt. It's not a flat disk.
Yeah, like a wave, like a little wave.
Yeah, it's a twisted disk. And they calculated, first of all, they had to prove that the warping that they're observing was not statistical noise, that it was actually real. And they did, observations and calculations, said, yep, this is actually real. This is a real thing that's happening. Then they calculated what would it take to create that gravitational warping. And they figured that, if you had a body, a planet, that was at least the mass of Mars, and it was 60 AUs away, and tilted 8 degrees to the disk of the Kuiper Belt, it would create this warping. They modeled it, so that's what they predict. So now they believe that there's actually a planet out there with these characteristics, and now they just have to go look for it, just like with Planet 9. So
they found it because of that warp. It's interesting because the Milky Way itself has a wave in it caused by the gravitational interaction with Andromeda.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a similar kind of thing. Yeah. They also, by the way, astronomers think they're really zeroing in on Planet 9. So they may actually confirm that thing within the next year or so. We'll see. That'll be cool.
Well, then this would be 10.
This would be 10. Yeah.
Yep. Steve, you know what's really cool?
Or would this one be 9 and Planet 9?
Yeah, that you won, Jay. We know what's coming.
Planet 8.5.
Wow, Bob, really? You think that I'm that shallow? I wouldn't have something to add to the Planet 10
Go ahead, Chase. Thing. What's cool?
I mean, Bob's right. I did win, and that's what I was going to say. I'm just saying there are other things I may have brought up. You don't have to be so hurtful to me, you know?
Your words are hurtful.
All right. All of
I mean, wait.
Means-
now, Coven was there. She saw that I won, that I swept everyone. I basically won the episode tonight. She was here. She could say.
I'm pretty impressed.
See?
That's how I felt last
just
week.
Just tell Kara.
You were going to make me go first because I'm new, but it's all right.
It's a privilege. Going first is a privilege.
Absolutely.
Just call Kara up and say, I had a great time. The guys are cool. Man, Jay is so smart. Like, what's up with Jay?
I am writing this down. Like, I'm gonna quote you, except I'm going to say it like it's totally my opinion.
Okay, awesome. I love
Coven, you're a communicator. You'll sell
what
it.
Matters is that you worked your way through these items and had something intelligent to say. Whether or not you got the answer right or not doesn't matter unless you're a shallow, pathetic person like Jay. All right. Now, having said all of that, all of this means that Australian scientists report a new method to convert atmospheric CO2 directly into a form of coal is the fiction. Because nobody's done that. But yes, a lot of people have figured out ways to capture atmospheric CO2 and use that CO2 as fuel. Absolutely. And there was a new method that was presented by Australian scientists. They came up with an enzyme that was able to convert the CO2 into methane. And of course, methane is a major component of natural gas. It's a fuel. And so that's all you really need to do. If you could take CO2 from the atmosphere, turn it into fuel, and they said they could do it just using like a solar panel. So you could have, you know, that could be powered by whatever, but you could power it, for example, by solar panels, convert CO2 into fuel. Then when you burn that fuel, you return the CO2 to the atmosphere. But the whole process is carbon neutral, right? Because you're just taking carbon out of the atmosphere, putting it back in. You're not releasing previously sequestered CO2. So that would be a carbon neutral thing. But yeah, I couldn't find anyone anywhere that made coal out of atmospheric CO2. So it's always hard to prove a negative, right? But that's not the news item, and I could not find that anywhere. But lots of people working on turning CO2 into liquid or gaseous fuels, and this was another one. But the good thing about this kind of technology, and there are – you could also, of course – once you get to any kind of hydrocarbon, you could make gasoline, right? You could just keep carrying the process forward. If we could keep our existing fleet of cars, you know, and just we would burn fuel that was made from carbon in the atmosphere, so we're not, again, pulling carbon out of the ground. The other thing is that even cars aside, even if we go over to all electric cars, obviously there are still things like jet fuel where we're going to need to burn gasoline. But also for farming, you know, we use hydrocarbons, you know, natural gas mostly in order to make the artificial nitrogen fertilizer. And so that farming could be more carbon neutral if we weren't using, you know, fossil fuels for part of the process. So this could also reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture, which would be awesome. As always, we can do this now. There's multiple methods where people have figured out ways of capturing CO2 and turning it into fuel. The question is always, can it be industrialized, right? Can this be scaled up some kind of mass industrial process that's cost effective? Yep. If it's not cost effective, it ain't going to happen. The answer is we don't know, right? Until somebody tries to do it. But this is the starting point, which is why you read. So now we're in that phase, guys, right, where we're reading these news items about, capturing CO2 to make fuel. But it is going to be 5 to 10 years before we know if any of these things pan out. Jeez. And probably 15 to 20 years before any of them are actually implemented, if they do fully pan out and are cost effective.
Jesus, that's too long.
I know. That's why we're in the hype phase where people are thinking about it and all this preliminary stuff is coming out, and then people will forget about it. And then suddenly 20 years from now, everyone will be doing it, but or not, or it'll just fade away if it doesn't pan out or something else eclipses it, you know, is better than it. So, but it is interesting to read the basic science that, it's possible to do it. We have now the chemical process, the enzymes, whatever necessary to make the reactions happen, it can theoretically be done. But yeah, it will take a while before we know if it's going to actually have any industrial impact. Well, good job, everyone.
Thank you, Steve. Thank
yeah.
you.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, Jay, really. Especially you, Jay.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for. Not everyone. You said good job, everyone.
Again, whatever. It's the analysis that matters, not necessarily where you put your nickel down.
If
but
you
yes,
say
congratulations,
I like
Jay.
I like that.
All right, Evan, bring us home with a quote.
"We are not afraid of predators. We're transfixed by them, prone to weave stories and fables and chatter endlessly about them, because fascination creates preparedness, and preparedness, survival. In a deeply tribal way, we love our monsters." And that's a quote from E.O. Wilson.
I totally agree with that quote.
E.O.
That's a good quote. It's a good quote. We do love our monsters.
That's very much Jay and I, tribal life.
Yeah, Jay and I are going to be talking about Jurassic Park at our workshop at Nexus. This is part of why I think we're fascinated with movies like about T-Rex and killer dinosaurs, because we are fascinated with predators. And I do think there probably is a survival instinct in there. It makes sense.
It does make sense. It makes perfect sense.
Well, Coven, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun having you on the show.
It was really fun to be here. Thanks for having me.
I hope you'll come back and join us sometime.
I would love
to. Yeah, thanks, Coven.
And keep up the good work. You have a column that comes out in Forbes. You also have a very good Facebook page, which I go to almost every day looking to see what you got posted there. What else are you doing? Where else can our listeners find you?
Find me on Twitter at KSenopathy. I'm also involved in the upcoming film Science Moms that explores the world of parents who choose to raise their kids with facts and not fear and hype. So again, that movie is called Science Moms, and it's super exciting. It's a short documentary crowdfunded film that's coming out later this summer.
Cool.
Awesome. Nice.
Yeah, definitely let us know when that comes out so we can plug it. Maybe we'll bring you back to talk about it.
I will.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.